Welcome to Sober Dad Crew, the podcast where we talk about all things sobriety, recovery, parenting, music, tattoos, work, and more. For more information, please visit SoberDadCrew.com. My guest this episode is Timothy J. Smith. Tim has worked in the music industry for 26 years, including helping to produce all the soundtrack compilations for Stranger Things. Tim, welcome to Sober Dad Crew.
Thank you, Stephen. Thanks for having me on. This is fantastic. It's great to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm very excited. I'm going to start off as I usually do and ask you how many kids you have.
Sure. I have two daughters. And as of the last month, I now have two teenagers living in my house. So 15 and 13.
Oh, so you don't yet have a driver?
Not yet. Soon.
I just got a second driver. So my oldest is 20. So I've sort of been down the driver road. Yeah. And in New York State, when you first get your license, you cannot drive after 9 p.m. unless you're going to work or school. And somehow the oldest, and I don't remember this being true, said we did not hold him to that rule. And I thought, well, that seems very strange because that's the law. And correct. So then there's this drama around, was I held to the same rules as my older brother? And she's, so many, many conversations around that. Not always fun. I think a plate was thrown or slammed one night.
It happens. Some dramatics.
Yeah, teenagers like the dramatics. I remember my oldest once in my old house, hollow core doors, and he tried to get a good slam.
Sure.
In a hollow core door, it's not satisfying for a teenager to slam. It's more of a whoop.
Yeah. It doesn't give that great exclamation point.
Yeah, that we had when we were young, when doors exactly. were doors
and when doors were doors.
Phones had cords.
Indeed.
So did you always want to be a dad?
Yes, absolutely. I grew up the youngest of seven children in South Orange, New Jersey. And so growing up in the 70s and 80s, it's, as a Catholic Irish, the idea of the family and was always there. And I always felt it, in my soul that this was something I was destined to do. I wasn't exactly sure when or how I was going to get there. And as it did turn out, I was nearly 40 when I had my first daughter. But that was, kind of the way the trajectory of my life had gone up to that point.
Yeah. I grew up in the 70s and 80s, Unitarian Universalist, not quite the same as Catholic, but I also always kind of knew and felt the dad thing for whatever, I don't know what it was, but I just kind of, I remember being seven and just thinking, someday I'm going to be a dad. And, now I have four. So I guess I
right. do that. And that's a big family, and it's a big family. It's a big responsibility. I mean, growing up in the 70s and 80s, it was just automatically assumed. It's like, what do you want to be when you grow up, and how many kids do you want to have? And those weren't offensive questions to ask. They were just, it was assumed that you were going to have a family. And I just always, to me, it was always kind of being able to build on that, but I had no concept, and I guess nobody really does until you actually do have children, what an educational experience it is, and what a mind-blowing experience it is, in both directions.
Yeah, and expensive. Yeah,
expensive. Oh, dude.
I think even more now. I mean, and most listeners know, my younger two are my stepkids, but I consider them my kids, so it's sort of like a little bit around too, which has some interesting perspective, but the world is expensive for folks. And
the world is expensive. Yeah. Yeah. I look at my parents. I mean, I look at my parents, you know, raising seven children, you know, in the 60s, 70s and 80s. And, you know, and I sit there and I say, you know, you just can't build them like that anymore. I mean, it's just not and be economically sound. I mean, I'm not saying my parents were working class and they worked hard. But I think today a family of seven, I mean, if I can't imagine feeding a family of seven on just what I have to do, you know, at ShopRite on a weekly. I mean, it's crazy.
Absolutely. And you know, and working class now means something really different. You know, it is a different economic world in which we live in. And so folks who were, you know, what we call working class in the 60s and 70s, they could buy a house, you know, and the cost of, you know, college wasn't what it is now. I mean, one of the people I work with, a younger person, he said, yeah, my wife and I have $150,000 of student loan debt. I mean, like, how do you even begin to chip right. away at that? It yeah. just is, it's nuts.
Well, to me, it's, you know, it's just what is, you know, we're not, and we certainly weren't. I mean, taught, you know, kind of the economics, balancing a checkbook, just, you know, the basic things of survival of growing up. They wanted to teach us algebra. Okay, that's fine. But I think that there is something, you know, I try to with my teenage daughters who want, you know, this and that and everything, but you have to teach them the value of a dollar. And my oldest, you know, has started working, you know, I mean, you know, part-time, but on the weekends, but understands that this is how you earn money. And it's not just handed to you. I had my first job when I was 12, working at the Our Lady of Sorrows Rectory, making $1.50 an hour. And obviously, it wasn't about the cash; it was about the responsibility and the duty. So it's a different world.
Yeah, I remember saying to the oldest at one point, and this was when I was, you know, a single parent, which is definitely its own economic thing. And he's like, "But you just got paid." And I was like, right. Dude, there's not a magic bucket where it all just goes. And I did. I said, yep. I said, here, like, let's sit down. This is the rent. Or I guess I said, this is what I bring in a month, every 2 weeks. Here's the rent. Look at the rent as a portion of one of those paychecks. It is a significant portion of that paycheck.
Significant. No, absolutely.
So now we still got to go 2 weeks. And in those 2 weeks, I think you want to eat.
Correct.
And I think you want.
And you want the lights on.
And the internet. Because, boy, in this day and age, if the power and the internet goes out, you would just think the world had come to an end. Or actually, last time the power went out, the younger two said, well, good, the internet still works. I said, no, it requires electricity to work. You know, and then I said to him, like, and here's gas and here's all this stuff. And it was a very constructive conversation, you know, and now he's not going the college route. So he's working and he really gets, like,
oh, yeah,
you know, you work hard for money.
Right.
And then there's expenses that come out of it.
Well, I always tell these. I speak to students at the who are graduating from my alma mater, which is the University of Georgia, and they reach out to me like, you know, I want to get into the music business. How do I get into the music business? And you know, and I try to, you know, kind of frame it out for them. And you know, aside from you know, just telling them, you know, you have all of this field ahead of you. You have all this time, just keep moving the ball forward. But what you really want to do is, you know, not think so much about the money, but about the education. Always be learning. Just because you have that degree doesn't mean that you stop learning. I'm on the job, you know, at Sony for 26 years, and I learned something today. You know, every single day, you have to always be a student. And that's the thing, because paradigms are always shifting, and you have to kind of be able to, you can't use a 2001 template in 2024. And especially, you know, and we'll get into it, the sobriety. I mean, it's using new templates, new paradigms, new ways of looking at things and rolling with it and not understanding it sometimes.
Absolutely. And I totally want to talk about your job and all of that. But, you know, if we can pivot a little and you're kind of willing to talk a little bit about, you know, your relationship with alcohol and your story, and then we'll kind of circle back to the more pleasant topics of music.
No, listen, I don't find talking about alcohol and my relationship or my ex-alcohol. You know, I look back on it as one of those things that I just said, as an extraordinarily educational force in my life. And it really, you know, it from a young age, I grew up with, anxieties and what would be called, you know, today maybe ADD or, you know, these depression. And I found myself really obsessed with music. But I also, in social situations, I found myself, you know, very, very nervous and very kind of feeling, you know, like, you know, when you're the youngest of seven, you have to walk into a room and you don't open your mouth. You have to read the room. You have to kind of see what's going on first, because, you know, you have to know what the shot is before you call it. And that was something I learned, you know, I realized that at a later age. But with drinking, I always found that it was kind of this like soother, you know, it kind of takes the edge off. And now is what they refer to now as self-medicating. I was overdosing, as it were. So that was my relationship with it. It was something I really leaned on and leaned into, and just felt every event could be an alcoholic event. And even if it wasn't, I would make it an inappropriately alcoholic event.
Kid's birthday party? 100%.
Kid's birthday party. Kid's first birthday party. My oldest, I got a keg. I got a keg and put it on the back deck. And I didn't even think anything about it. Well, friends are coming over, right? I made it about me. And it was just, you know, again, you know, when you're doing all this kind of self-reflection, you're sitting going, wow. It's just, it really, you are on another planet. But maybe that's kind of where you want to be, you know, at that point.
Yeah. Now, what was your sort of pivot point? And, you know, do you do a program? You know, did you kind of hit a metaphorical or literal wall?
Yeah, I did. Right now I'm in my 11th year of sobriety, and then that is, you know, no alcohol, no cigarettes, no weed. I never was great at weed either. It was never my thing.
Well, now you just walk around everywhere and it's just,
it's right there. Yeah.
I mean, Ithaca, New York just smells like a giant Grateful Dead show right now.
Yeah. I mean, and it's out there, and I understand it's way more potent now, and you know, it's a lot more acceptable. But I mean, you know, look, if that's your life, that's fine. I can't levy any judgment on it. But for me, you know, I had lost both of my parents by the time I was 35, and so, you know, that hit me really hard, because, you know, I was close with my parents, and my family was a very close knit. But I also, you know, found myself in being in the music business and being in these social events, and alcohol was always part of those social events. And I could see people who could just have one or two and walk away and be like, they're done for the night. Now, I could never comprehend that. That to me, it was such a foreign concept of, you know, if you're going to go out for one, well, you got to put another one on that, because you got to go out for 11. Because it's like, because why would you just? So for me, I guess it was at the top of January 2013. I just gotten back my job at Legacy Recordings, which is the catalog division of Sony Music Entertainment. And we were doing a party for the release of Willie Nelson's album at the time, called Let's Face the Music and Dance. And it was a release party for that. And I remember that there was a lot of Lone Star beer. I was drinking a lot of Lone Star beer. And I had my daughter at the time, she was 3 or 4 years old. So I was, you know, I had already, you know, been a dad, and I had known, you know, that I was kind of spiraling down, because every time it was just getting worse and worse, and it wasn't getting any better. But the story is, and I've told this story numerous times, is that, you know, the next morning I woke up after this party, and I was wretched. I just, you know, my drink of choice was beer, but I would drink, you know, 15 beers in a sitting and just not even think twice about it. It was just what I did. And the next morning I woke up and I was just wretched. And my daughter asked me, she goes, "Daddy, you know, read me a story." And I'm just like, "Oh, come on. Come on." And I was like, "Okay, okay." So I'm reading a story. I'm like, "Okay, Riley, all right, here we go." I'm reading the story, and she starts kind of, she's sitting on my lap, just kind of covering her face a little bit. And I'm like, "Honey, what's going on? What's the matter?" She goes, Daddy, you're making me stink. Boos.
Yeah.
And it was just like, boom. Like it was that moment where I was sitting there and I said, I could either be a dad or I could be a drunk, but I could not be both. And I had to make a decision right then and there. So a friend of mine, one of my best friends in the world, had entered the program a year before that. And he was one of my favorite drinking buddies of all time. And he went in, and I was kind of like, you know, once you start seeing guys leave the ship, you're kind of getting the feeling that, wait a minute, something's up. But I went the next day, I went to a meeting. That night, January 11th, 2013, was the last time I ever had a drink, last time I ever had a cigarette, last time I had anything. And I just decided that was it. And now it's been one day at a time ever since.
So that was your older daughter?
My eldest, yeah.
Yeah, so mm-hmm. The younger one, and I have this too, right? Yeah, so my older one. And I was definitely like the medicinal, you know, 2-3 glasses of wine. You know, that was my like,
sure.
And the anxiety thing really resonates. And, you know, and I remember being, and when I was a kid, half day kindergarten, and I couldn't get through the half day. I was like so anxious. And, you know, this is the 70s. Yep. They didn't have any friggin' words for this stuff.
Hyper.
So you find ways to deal with it, but it is different. My older one, you know, remembers, but the younger one was probably 2 or 3 when I stopped. So she just doesn't really remember,
right?
You know, that and the temper that goes with that, and, you know, the short fuse, all the things. So, you know, it's an interesting journey to have those two kids, you know, have a slightly different experience. And now, of course, my stepkids have no idea. You know, my wife also is sober, so they, you know, they have no conception of me that is not, you know, this guy that's been sober for years and years and years and years and years. And like, I can't even fathom a world where I would have a drink. It is not, it would, everything I have today, you know, my marriage, everything, my job,
gone.
It's all because that night I chose to stop, like you. Like, there's that moment, and I was like, this is not good. And the direction this is going is only going to get worse and worse and worse.
Right. Right. And I always, you know, I say to people, I never preachy about it. What I say is that if I, Timmy Smith, can stop, anybody can. Because trust me, you know, I was not the guy with the strongest willpower. I had poor impulse control, all of this stuff that led me to the place where I was. But I think that when you start looking at life in values and what it is you value. And I sat there and I said, look, my kids are my everything. I always say that, the Prince song, I Would Die For You. I never really understood what it meant until I had children, you know, and it is that, you know, where you just feel that. And it is just, you know, I didn't want to make their life stink.
Yeah. Literally or metaphorically. Also, yeah. Right. When I had kids, I realized also love songs, they were like dual, right? They were about sort of your partner or whatever. But then there is, like you said, that lens, especially a song like I Would Die For You, which, you know, is this thing of parenting. Like, if I could only absorb all the hard things, and you can't do that.
Right.
And probably you actually shouldn't do that.
No.
Nope. Because they won't be resilient. But as a parent, you just want to, you know, protect them or take away any of the pain or like absorb those things, or in the worst case, die instead of them.
Of course. But sometimes they have to take, the thing is, sometimes they have to take the blows. You don't want them to take fizzles, obviously. But life is tough, man. Life is tough. And the, you know, one of the books that I read that really helped me was, the book by M. Scott Peck, The Road Less Traveled. And it was, you know, the opening sentence of the book is just three words. And it's, life is difficult, period. Life is difficult, period. And the whole thing is that once you accept that and you understand that's the deal, you can transcend that. Because if you go into life thinking, well, life's easy. Well, no, because life is difficult, period. But you can transcend it. And once you understand that that is part of it, then you can accept it and then start moving on with the rest of your life. And so, as you said, you know, just kind of trying to transition for all of these things and showing your kids that this is how you kind of handle the adversity. This is how you kind of manage these paths, and you want to protect them, right? You want to, but if you shelter them, that goes, you know, sideways too, very quickly.
Yeah. And I remember, and I think I probably said this to all the kids now, no one promised you a road with no hills, mm-hmm. no bumps, and that is totally straight.
Correct.
I mean, life would be really boring if it was that too, but no one promised you that. And I think it's Brené Brown who also said, like, show me a kid that never struggled, and I'll show you a dysfunctional adult. I don't think I got the exact words right, but that's her quote. And I think it's
great
really,
line.
Really true. If you haven't struggled or learned to overcome things along the way, when you kind of hit adulthood and you're out there and works hard, you know, I've definitely had jobs like the one I have now, which is incredible. And I work with incredible people and I work for incredible people. And I've had jobs that 100% are not that, you know, which makes me appreciate what I do have more. And I think hardship makes you appreciate what you have more. And, you know, my grandmother always talked about being greatly blessed, even in the hard times, remembering your blessings.
Of course. Of course. And it's, and these jobs, all of this stuff, every single day, it's an education. As long as you're always learning, just be a student. And it is, some days it's overwhelming. Some days it's so much, but you're sitting there going, you know, you look at today and you just say, well, the good news is I'm not going to solve this by drinking, because I told myself this morning, I'm not drinking today, maybe tomorrow, but definitely not today. You know, definitely not today. And as long as you do that, when people say, you know, oh, it's, you know, these trite, you know, ODOT and, you know, one day at a time, it's no, that's how you got to do it. You got to do it one day at a time. And each day is beautiful. And then that once you're in that moment, you're in that kind of space, you kind of realize, and people, you know, people talk about old friends and was like, oh, do you remember that night we went out and the whole, and it's like, yeah, I mean, it was just like, it was beautifully ridiculous, you know? But I couldn't live that life now. And one of my biggest fears was when I was kind of nearing the end of my, you know, drunken road, was that one of my biggest fears, was becoming the old guy in the bar, which I always thought was the sad. And I grew up, you know, working in bars, bartending, you know, not bar, but bar backing, DJing. And I always would look at the old guys in the bar, you know, and sitting there going, I will never do that. But then, you know, I found myself kind of getting up there and I'm like, wait a minute, wait a minute. I'm the old guy in the bar. And it's just, you know, it's something that, you know, thank God that the wherewithal was there to say, let's stop this. And speaking of quotes, one of my favorite quotes that really kind of got me in the early days was, and I don't know who to attribute this to, but it's a great quote, is that there's a reason why the windshield is much larger than the rearview mirror, because what's happening ahead of you is so much more important of what's happened in the past behind you. And I'm just like, boom, you know? So.
Yeah. I mean, and that's a cool quote, because you can get so hung up on the past. I mean, you can get hung up on the past. You can also get hung up on the forward what ifs, but the past what ifs can just be an anchor. And, you know, there is importance of looking at your past and looking at your behavior and making sure you've dealt with the crap that you maybe put out there. But it's, you're doing that so that you get the windshield. I always say to people, there's a light at the end of the tunnel. It might be really far away, but it is always there and you can get there. I'm not saying it's going to be easy. I will not promise you it's going to be easy. But if you keep taking one step forward and another step forward, the light gets closer and it gets brighter. I mean, I feel like I said before, I don't think about drinking. It doesn't even, you know, factor to me. And I think there is a moment, I couldn't even pinpoint when it was in my sobriety, because it's been so long now. But there was a moment where all of a sudden you're like, oh, I do think about this less. It does not feel that hard. And I get that might not be everybody's journey, but for me, that was certainly my experience. And then, you know, not looking backwards in the mirror, but sort of reflecting on where you are and where you want to be.
Sure.
Definitely helps too.
Yeah. I mean, it's perspective and it's keeping yourself, you know, keeping eyes forward. And, you know, and if anybody needs kind of like, you know, I never preach it and I never say, you know, oh, you shouldn't, you know, everyone has their own journey. I just, you know, my kids understand daddy doesn't drink. Daddy used to drink but they don't have any real recollection of that. And, you know, but I just don't make a big deal of it. It's just not something I do. Through my sobriety, I've gone through a divorce and navigating that and now with my new girlfriend who's been wonderful through the whole process. But it's just, you know, again, it's, you know, she doesn't really drink and she will have like a glass of wine and sometimes she'll drink like 3/4 of it over the course of 2 hours. And there's still like that little bit in there. And I'm like, wait.
And you're like, what the hell is that?
You didn't finish that. She's like, yeah. Right. And there's 14 more.
And there's 14 more to go. Also, when you drank 15 beers, you must've really had to pee a lot. I mean, not to get like potty on this, but like, you would think that's a lot of liquid.
It's all calories too. I mean, I wasn't drinking Bud Light. I was drinking like stouts. I was drinking these like heavy beers. So I look at the pictures of myself when I was drinking, and it's not just in my gut, because I grew up, I could eat like a puma when I was a kid. And I was like, you know, I was like 60 pounds soaking wet. And I was, but once I started drinking, and it's just like, I see these pictures and my head is getting, all the weight was going in my head. And I just sit there and I go, you know, it just transformed me. And I realized that looking back now, I was like, well, I was at that party and I was pretty hammered. Yeah, there was a couple laughs, but I was not happy. You know, I wasn't happy. And the thing is, I'm not saying all these things was a sad story, but it was becoming a very sad story. I mean, because the thing is, when you're young, it's like, okay, you do it, but the older you get, you can't rebound from it. And I am amazed by, you know, some of my peers who I do see, you know, go out and you just see it in their faces the next day. And I'm just like, how do you do it? I don't know. I don't know how they do it. I couldn't.
You know, and it still really does intersect that professional world. Like it is an interesting world of, you know, conferences and stuff where that is still, I mean, it's like a built-in conference lubricant, you know, and it's still a thing and you still see it. And, you know, I've been for so long always the guy that didn't drink at those, but I've definitely worked with people who react poorly to someone that does not drink. They're usually the people who are drinking a lot. You're like a mirror on them and they don't like it, but it's difficult when they're,
it is. Boss. And, you know, especially when they used to be your drinking partner. I mean, it was, you know, and then when you kind of jump off the boat, but you know, I never made a big deal of it. They're like, oh, you don't drink. I said, nope. Well, you're just not drinking tonight, or just not drinking. But anyway, just, you know, and change the subject. And I have a ginger ale. I'm right here. I'm right here with you. But then, you know, when you're there and you realize when you were the one drinking too, you know, you're both on the same level, but when, you know, you're not drinking, you just see people kind of going down that ladder. You know, you're kind of sitting there going, huh, okay, ding, ding, checking out. And
yeah. Can I just go up to my hotel room and read?
I don't need to stay up till 5 o'clock in the morning, you know, solving the problems of the world and you know, draining another six pack and smoking another pack of cigarettes. It's just not something that interests me anymore. It's not because I'm better than anybody else. It's not something I choose to do anymore. And it's one less thing I have to worry about. And I realize that when I go out, and, you know, now it's like, oh, well, how am I going to get that ride home? Or how am I going to, do I have enough cigarettes for the night? I mean, all of these things that your mind used to go through. And now it's just like this. Yeah, I'm bringing my own car and I'm driving home tonight. I don't have to worry. I'm good.
I just have to worry about all the other assholes on the road, but I don't have to worry about myself.
Look, I you know, a lot of people who are near and dear to me and very close to me, they still have, you know, they're still much, very much entwined with alcohol. But I would never say to them, you know, come talk to me. I have, if anyone comes to me and says, hey, can I talk to you about anytime? But I never sit there and preach. I just don't do it. It works for me. And I know that if it has worked for me, and if I can do this, I am convinced that anybody can, because it's just, I'm stubborn Irish and you know, I couldn't see what a life was like without it. And I got really nervous about it, but day by day.
Right. And everyone has to hit their, whatever you want to call it, rock bottom or pivot point. And they're different for everybody. And, yeah, you know, mine was maybe not very dramatic, but it was my moment. Right. And I think it was great that I've said it before. I was fortunate that somehow along the way I figured it out so I could just turn the corner and be done. Again, that's not everybody's situation, but you have to hit that point where you're just done. And all the other things, just, it's too scary not change. And so you change. And, you know, and I remember early on, I, you know, as an old kind of grizzly punk guy, I was just like, well, I'll just tell people I'm straight edge, you know, because that was like a good way to frame it up and not have to talk about recovery. You know, it's sort of just like, oh, I just choose sobriety. It's all good. I like my seltzer and my lime. But there was a moment along the way, and it was really before I got the job I have now. And I put up something, I think it was for my 12th sober anniversary.
Yeah, yeah.
And I put it on LinkedIn, which I'd never done before. And I thought, holy shit, I've just interviewed for this job a couple times. I really want this job. Like, what if they see this? And what if they're like, well, forget that guy. And then I realized, wow, if that place did that, I wouldn't want to work there anyway. And so that moment was very pivotal in this moment where I was like, you know, I can be of service by being public about this because, you know, I have a, you know, a job where I run marketing and business development for an architecture firm with three offices in New York State. You know, I'm submitting proposals on $100 million projects. I have, you know, four kids and a wife, and like people don't look at me and think, oh, this is someone who had an issue with alcohol. So therefore I need to make sure that they see that I had and understand that and where I've come, so that if someone else along the way at work or whatever, you know, maybe needs to go to rehab or has some other, there are a lot of other things that aren't just
all these things.
It could be an eating disorder. It could be a lot of other things that we've created a culture and an environment that understands that people have struggles. And our job is to help support people, you know, in their struggles and their 100%. Triumphs, but especially
in their struggles. It's, and it is interesting. I mean, when you're talking about social media and here you are saying, well, what will they think if, you know, if I'm sober, if anything, when you reframe it, when you kind of, you know, from the other side of it, you're sitting there going, if I'm hiring somebody, I'm looking at going, this is a responsible guy. This is a guy who's, you know, who has pivoted and made his life. It's better than going onto their social media and seeing them with, you know, drunk, passed out and doing all this other stuff. And you're like, well, is this person reliable? It's kind of like, you know, again, it's just social media is, when I hit my anniversary of my 5-year or my 10-year anniversary, I found myself talking about it. It was the first time I really talked about my sobriety publicly. And obviously this is my first podcast talking about my sobriety, and it's very freeing. And I feel there's no shame in it whatsoever, because it's just for me, as like yourself, if this can be of service to somebody, if somebody can hear this and say, you know, this was not an instantaneous decision. I mean, I hit my bottom for sure, but there was a lot of run ups to the line and sitting there going, I can't do it. Run up to the line and then I can't do it. But finally it's, you know, and that's the human mind, because there's, because who doesn't, who, you know, the frightening aspect of the uncertainty of it. What is life without alcohol like? I don't know. I never did it. You know, or life with anxiety, or life without anxiety, or life not coping anxiety, trying to give some soothe, you know, to that thing. And being in a place where you're like, look, life is difficult, period, of course, but not having to run to the bottle or run to all of these other things, where you can kind of hit it head on and say, okay, we're going to try to do this. And it's not always successful, because we're human and we're, you know, we fail. But what I'm not going to fail in today is I'm not going to have a drink today. And there's a couple more hours left in the day, and I know I will not have a drink today. I'm vowing to that. Maybe tomorrow. We'll see what I say tomorrow. But I have an idea. I have an idea of what I'm going to say to myself tomorrow morning when I wake up. And then that's it. Then there's a new day. So we're living in an era right now where everything is fast cut, fast pace, fast everything. And you have to kind of stop and sit there and say, and take the inventory, as they say. And it's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful life.
Yeah. Sitting there with my 12-year-old tonight at dinner, my wife and the 8-year-old where I had his baseball, and she had her phone on the table, and like, she was getting texts. And I was like, we're eating together. And he was like, oh man, I want to look. I was like, the world will not end if you do not answer that text. You know, I was like, we're going to be done in like 10 minutes.
I know.
It'll but be it's okay. But they're so used to like that. It's a dopamine hit too. I mean,
you know, it's all there. The communication, the entertainment, the social lifeline, the social currency, the clout, all of that stuff. I mean, my daughters, I mean, as I said, I'm in the music business for 26 years. And I say, it's my daughters that kind of keep me hip on shit, you know, on the stuff that's happening about, you know, whether it's a rap feud or a Taylor Swift album that just dropped or whatever it is, the latest TikTok trend that they're using a Sony song in, they're, you know, I mean, this is the world in which they're living in. And to me, I'm very, I don't want to live that life, but it's fascinating to watch because, you know, you and I have, having grown up in the same era, it's very interesting to see, like, I'm grateful that I'm not growing up as a teen in this era. I think it's extraordinarily challenging right now, than more than we had. I mean, of course, it's always tough being a teen, but right now it's, everything's just so visual and public and weird.
Yeah, like, no, yeah, we don't have movies of our dumb shit.
No, thank God.
And social media is such, you know, there's good stuff about it, right? This podcast, I mean, I reach people through that. But, you know, the conversation of, like, when you let, you know, the kid get, because what they want now really are Snapchat and TikTok. No. They don't want Instagram. They sure as hell do not want Facebook. 100%. That's for people who are like 900 years old. You know? But also, back to the rap feud with my 20-year-old, a lot of conversations about the Drake-Kendrick Lamar feud. I've never feuded. Fascinating stuff. Yeah, as a marketing guy, interesting, fascinating stuff. Yeah, so talk about your job a little bit, because you have, you know, kind of a cool job.
But, you know, you have a cool job too. I think that, you know, just to, you have to, first of all, you got to do what you love, right? You have to do, I always say you have to do what you love, and, you know, money shouldn't be the priority. It's, you know, your time here is very limited. So you got to do what you love to do. And for me, music was always, I mean, I have all my ticket stubs and all my, you know, my shrines, my, you see my replacements back there. I mean, the drinking, smoking, rock and roll. That's what I was supposed to be as a teen.
Back when you got to smoke in the clubs where you saw music.
Great.
Isn't it nice to go now and not smell? I used to have a jacket in the winter because I grew up in Maine and whatever. I used to have the jacket that I would wear to the club because it was going to smell. I didn't smoke, but it was going to smell like
smoke. That's when cigarettes were good for you, right? That's when they were, it was considered a vegetable. But I mean, back, you know, it was just for me, music had always been very much, you know, just integral to my life. I was just, as I said, in high school, I was more interested in making mixtapes than studying trigonometry or algebra. It was just mixtapes and music. And that's, you know, I wasn't really great on my history tests, but I could tell you all the liner notes from, you know, the Replacements, Let It Be. It just was this stuff that just resonated with me. So, I ended up, you know, playing in a band, out of high school, and we played up in Boston, and we had some success, but we were 20 years old and we were not, you know, they call it the music business, not the music friendships. And I realized that you have to have a music business sense in to navigate this, because you can be a great musician, but if you don't know how to make that transition into a business sense and operate it as a business, or try to trust somebody to run your business, it's not good. So I ended up going back to school. I ended up going to the University of Georgia, down in Athens, where one of my favorite bands of all time were from, REM, and that was, you know, kind of the my reason for going down there. But also, you know, going back to your original, you know, conversation of putting myself through college, because by the time I came back home from Boston and I said to my parents, okay, I'm ready to go to college, Mom and Dad, they're like, all right, well, Timmy, that money that we had socked away for your college, well, that's gone. So, you know, so you got to put yourself through. So I did. I went down, I got in-state tuition at the University of Georgia, moved down with my girlfriend at the time. And I went down there and I DJed down there, and I wrote for a music newspaper called The Flagpole down there. And went to all these shows, and I thought I was going to be a rock writer. That was my thing. And then I came back to Jersey as soon as I graduated. And you know, and I did some kind of odds and ends jobs. And then, you know, I applied to Sony Music Entertainment, and I got the call from, from the hiring manager there. And I thought I was being pranked. I couldn't believe it. But I went in and I did the interview and I said, you know, I said Kathleen Kelly was her name, and I call her, I refer to her as Saint Kathleen because she was my patron saint of the music business. I just said to her, I said, listen, Kathleen, I'm not really good at Excel spreadsheets, and I'm just barely proficient in Word documents, but give me a chance. I'll learn. I'll do whatever it needs to take. I said, just give me the opportunity. I will be the fry cook. I will be the window washer. Whatever you need me to do, just give me the opportunity to lift my head off my pillow tomorrow and say, I'm heading into Sony Music to do work. And she did. And I started off as a per diem, and that was, you know, August of 98. And so right now I'm working with Legacy Recordings, which is the catalog division of Sony Music. And it houses the catalogs of RCA, Columbia, and Epic. And my job is, you know, amongst other things, is, you know, kind of looking at our catalog, which has over a million songs in it, and looking at what's been delivered to digital service providers like iTunes, Spotify, and what has not. And if it has not, why not? And how do we prioritize that? And how do we deliver that? Because these are assets that are monetizable. And also, this is work that the artist has done. And just because it was released as a 12-inch single in 1986 doesn't mean it shouldn't be digitized and be available on these streaming services. So that's kind of the jux of kind of the underlying thing. But I also, you know, do soundtracks, work with music supervisors to do soundtracks. I did the soundtracks for all the Stranger Things shows that we released through Sony Music. So it's been a great experience. I mean, and I still pinch myself that I'm able to work with, you know, these artists like Springsteen, Miles Davis, Billy Joel, and Cheap Trick. You know, I mean, these bands that these artists who I just idolized. And I still do. I sit there and I go, you know, it's a great privilege and an honor to be working with these artists, because I'm here because of these artists. So it's not about me. It's about being in service to the artists, as you know, just being in service.
Yeah, a couple things. Maybe I'm the only person in the world that hasn't actually watched Stranger Things. So
it's, you know, growing up in the 80s, but you and I think you and I are, you know, around the same age. We have, you know, in our early 50s. And so growing up in the 80s, this is a show that really, really hones in on that. And I was skeptical at first because I was like, well, are they going to nail it? Or is it going to be just jokey? Are they going to go like, you know, just so over the top with the, and let me tell you something, it's like beautiful. These guys, the Duffer Brothers, just nailed it. The essence and the nuance of the 80s stuff. It's very funny. Very, very, very well done. I recommend it. And just to watch the first season, it's pretty impressive. And the music's great too.
And we're probably both guys that had a crush on Winona Ryder back in the day.
100%. She's fantastic in it. And I think that it's all, you know, very tongue in cheek, and it's all very, it's a sweet reminder of where we came from, and just, you know, kind of, you know, what that era was like. And it's refreshing. It's a refreshing look at it. And I will tell you, my two kids love it. They think it's fantastic. And so, you know, and it's interesting. I've tried to do that kind of system. Oh, you like the 80s? So, you know, so we go back and we will start watching some John Hughes movies, right? And we watch like 16 Candles. Loved it. Meanwhile, you know, at Breakfast Club. And it's like, and we're laughing, and it's just like, it was just very fun, like these funny movies. So it's able to kind of bond with them on that, you know, on that. And they were also like, oh my God, you were alive when Nirvana was playing? Oh, amazing. That was so long ago.
I remember when the first time I heard Nevermind was shortly after my 21st birthday in a divey ass bar in Portland, Maine. And I was like, holy God, like, this is so different than what's happening now. Because I was a punk kid in the 80s, and I was listening to Suicidal Tendencies, you know, REM, and, you know, Love Tractor, another Athens band that a lot of people, you know, probably don't remember. But because you lived there, and they're a cool band. And B-52s, and and, you know, Generation, right. like all that stuff. And then the, you know, it was still there back when we called it underground or whatever. And 120 minutes was on MTV when MTV played music. And it kind of like went away a little bit as metal took over. And then all of a sudden that riff on Smells Like Teen Spirit. And I was like, holy shit. Yeah. This is incredible. And then a lot of cool, interesting stuff followed that. I mean, you know, his story is just tragic, and, you know, the perils of fame are real. You know, somehow we very can't just so. Like appreciate the artist and the music. We have to deify some of them and all this stuff. Like, let people go to the grocery yeah. store.
Yeah, it, you know, it was interesting because the timing of Nevermind was, you know, the year before that is when I was playing with my band Astronaut up in Back Bay, Boston. And Back Bay, Boston, by the way, is probably not the greatest place for a starving artist band to be playing. One of the highest rent places in Boston.
Even more so now.
We learned that very quickly. Yeah. Oh, dude. I mean, unbelievable. But we had a lot of great opportunities. So we were managed by the guy who was managing Buffalo Tom at the time and Bullet La Volta. You know, they shared a space with Juliana Hatfield and the Lemonheads. And we had, you know, we got opportunities to open up for Smashing Pumpkins at TT the Bears, and played with Dinosaur Jr. at CBGB's and Rollins Band. So we had all of these things kind of rolled out for us in that year of 1990-91, but we just, as I said, we were the little band that couldn't. We recorded at Fort Apache. We had all of these, but it was just, we just couldn't get it together because it was just, you know, you're 20 years old and it's just coming at you so fast and you're just trying to, you can't really sort it through. So, and this is a true story. So the band I was in, Astronaut, we came back from Boston and I say that we broke up on September 1st, Nevermind came out on September 11th, 1991. So all of these bands that we had been playing with the year prior were all getting snapped up by these major yeah. labels. And we're sitting there going, ah! You know, but for me, for Nirvana, is that I remember the first time I heard that, and I'm sitting there, and I was in my car, and I was driving back from, I think, probably from City Gardens, and just clear as a bell. And I say, God damn it. They did it. They did it. They meshed Cheap Trick and Pixies together. And here it is. Oh my. And I couldn't believe it. And it was huge and it was gigantic. And I was like elated, but I was also really bitter. And now as I can sit back and sit there and go, oh wow. I mean, all of these baby bands that the Replacements and Soul Asylum and the Pixies and the Cure and all of these things that were just REM, all these things that were just so integral to my rock and roll punk rock foundation. They are now people are finally getting it. And people like me and you were like, oh, we knew about this shit about 5 years ago. But yeah.
I know the Cure just had like their best selling tour ever. And there was this video of Robert Smith. It was like at the end of a show. And he just, you can just see how grateful he is that not only have like us old dudes stuck with him, but like younger people, like, you know, you share it with their kids and they fall in love with it. And it's still like, that's a band that still sounds like incredible.
Because he's legit. Yeah. He's not sitting there at the cash register at the mic. He is fully vested. And the thing is that, you know, I respect the shit out of that, the Cure. I mean, I mean the Cure, the Smiths, all that stuff that was just so important, you know, so important to me. And to grow up in that era where it was just these albums were just coming out and it was just music. And it's wonderful. So something like Nevermind that my daughter, you know, my oldest daughter loves Nirvana and loves Radiohead. And Radiohead for me were, you know, enormous. And she found all this stuff kind of organically. And so we sit there and we you know, shoot the shit about about REM and Nirvana, and she's like, "Oh, Dad, I love this song off In Utero called Scentless Apprentice." I'm like,
"I've done my work. Great. I've done my job.
I've done my work." Yeah, yeah. And it's and she loves the Pixies, and that was another band that I, you know, over the summer I went to go see them. I went to go see them down at the Stone Pony, and I was like, I was all in tears because I'm sitting there going, these guys might be the punk rock Beatles. I mean, this is like every song is just so like, it's just, it just is in your soul. And you're like, oh my God. I was like, why weren't these guys? I guess because they just looked weird.
Yeah. My high, one of my high school history teachers turned me on to them. And then for, I don't know, 7 or 8 years in Ithaca, in the local Gannett paper here, I had a music column. You know, I was trying to like make that happen as a music writer, and it was not the right time.
Sure. But
if bands came to town, I interviewed them and I got tickets, and you know, it was great.
So good.
And I got to interview him. It was like
Frank. Yeah, yeah.
Frank, so like cool and genuine guy. Yeah, I got, you know, I interviewed Billy Bragg. So I got to interview some like super cool people along the way. It's just, you know, you find that you don't always make a living doing the thing you love, but you got to find like what, like doing this podcast has meaning. And
of course,
you know, side note, just it's good to give Boston a shout out as like a place with an incredible music scene, because growing up in Portland, Maine, you know, we're so adjacent. And I don't know, do you remember the band Chucklehead?
Sure.
You know, like one of those sax players went to my high school. So, you know, what amazing. An amazing band. I think they just sort of faded away as happens, but like what a cool, interesting, you know, band that maybe nobody really remembers now, but I'm also a believer in probably like the best musicians out there none of us know about.
Oh, sure. No, I mean the Boston scene was really wild. I mean, it was, everybody was in the band, and Cambridge scene was hopping. They had so many cool places, the Channel, TT, the Bears, Middle East. I mean, all of these places, and bands came through there all the time. And it was really, it was a great experience. And I met some wonderful friends up there, but you know, the band is like, I remember going to the Ratskeller and seeing the Mighty Mighty Bosstones. I'm like, what is this? This is nuts. I mean, because, you know, but it was a very exciting time, because it was, a time where it was pretty much all kind of under the radar. So it was like, it was our little secret. And then, you know, sharing it with the world is, you know, is an amazing thing. And I think it was great to be in that kind of era, and seeing all these, you know, scenes. The New York scene was cool, but the Boston scene was cool. So for sure, you know, for that area, it's a lot of interesting stuff came out of that scene. For sure.
And I was in the Pacific Northwest from 90 to 96, because I went to school in Portland.
Okay. Oregon.
So it was when all that stuff was happening. And it's
right there. Yeah.
And like, you didn't really see it as much living in it. I mean, Portland was sort of secondary to Seattle, and there were some really great bands, but I worked in this bookstore, and the owner's son was like the tour manager for Everclear. But that sort of was like even the next wave of some of that stuff. It wasn't quite first wave, but bands that definitely.
But paved the way. I mean, the thing is, for these bands to kind of come in and say, okay, well, you know, this is a style of music. It doesn't have to be, you know, pretty. It doesn't have to be pretty. It can be grungy. It can be, you know, it can be a little bit gnarly. And certainly, there are some that really succeeded at it, and there's some that failed at it. And I think that, and then there's some that were just completely manufactured and overblown and all that stuff. But out of that, when you go back and you listen to that, when you listen to these, you know, 90s stations or whatever, when someone's playing the 90s, it just takes you right back there. And it's like, that was pretty fun. That was pretty fun to grow up in and to kind of experience, you know, what that was, because I'm not exactly sure. I mean, look, it was radio, right? It was radio. It was mixtapes. It was, you know, whereas right now everything is, you know, held on the, it's all on the phone, yeah. Right? And so no one listens to really radio anymore. So that window of time from 90 to 96, there was a lot of interesting stuff that was going on. And so, You know, and then on top of that, there's, you know, there's the punk rock, there's the rock, but there's also, what a great era for hip hop too. I mean, hip hop was like, there was some like banging stuff that was going on in hip hop. And you go back and you listen to that going, oh my God, how did I sleep on that? I mean, but, you know, but then, you know, it's, to me, I've always looked at artists like Public Enemy, who, you know, just at the top of the 90s with, you know, Fear of a Black Planet and Takes a Nation of Millions. I always look at those as punk rock records, not rap records, because they are, you know, those guys showed a lot more stones than some of these punk rock bands that were going down. They're kind of skirting around the issue. And these guys are like, bam, there it is. And you're sitting there going, and just the soundscapes were just so intense. So it was great. And so I'm looking for that. You know, I always admire that kind of bravery, you know, in the music where you're just, if you're legit and it's just kind of like, you know, you're just saying it as it is. And it's not manufactured, and it's not this manufactured rage, and it's not this kind of thing where, you know, you're trying for shock value. I think intelligence is a shock value these days.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, you don't have to dumb it down. I mean, the thing is that I think that if you can walk away from something and be like, wow, I learned something from that. That's shocking.
Yeah. And being willing to learn something. Yeah. We're in it's a weird time in this country for sure. You know, as you like look at, you know, Trump on trial, and it's bonkers and.
Well, it's theater, right? I mean, it's all theater on the left and on the right. It's all theater. Everybody's just trying to get airtime, but it's like, it all starting to sound like, the Charlie Brown teachers, the wah, 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 wah. I mean, it's just words, but they're not relating to anything that's logical. And I'm not saying I'm some high philosopher here, like, oh, they are not speaking my, it's just, I'm sitting there going, it just doesn't make any sense to me. And then I start to glaze over and I'm like, is this even real? You know? And I'm like, okay, I'll go back and listen to my music. Yeah,
but
that's where I'll find my songs. Yeah,
and at the same time though, like people's economic status is just slipping, right? So there's all this noise, and meanwhile, you know, the dollar that people earn at work goes a shorter distance.
Oh, yeah, I mean, look at mortgage rates. I mean, and mortgage rates and all of this stuff. It's like, listen, I'll tell you what. You know what? You know what's good? Being a politician, they're good. They're fine.
Some
they
don't good have to worry healthcare.
About it. Well, it's not even the healthcare. It's just that it takes a certain level. Right, I believe that there was politicians who went in there to do things for the greater good. I am more dubious more than ever of the motivation to get into that, because the waters are so muddy right now, and I think that I don't believe in either side, really. To be honest with you, I think it's all nonsense, and I don't want to be that cranky old guy saying, oh, back in my day, but it's. There used to be conversations. There used to be a dialogue, and it didn't have to be all of this shouting, all of this noise, all of this, I'm right. You know, you need to sit back and humble yourself sometimes and be like, all right, I was kind of wrong about that, but I am kind of right about this one. Right. So, you know, it's a give and take.
And I also feel like there's a time, and you remember, you know, Walter Cronkite, everyone agreed when he said something factual. We might not agree on why that's a thing, you know, call it people who are unhoused, right? We might not agree to the causes of that, but we actually agree that it's real. And it feels like we live in a time now where you can just say trees are purple and
well, right, correct,
and well, die on that cross.
Anything contrary to that, yeah. And if you say anything contrary to that, but what is it, you know, Stephen? It's infotainment, right? It's all noise. It's all part of, you know, there's no, it's very hard to find good data these days and just to try to be, you know, so yeah, the static and clatter can really distract you, but as long as you kind of recenter yourself, and that's what I think what's important is recenter yourself, and whether that's kind of just remembering, you know, the kids and the family and being like, okay, I look at myself and I'm like, look, I'm on the back nine. I'm not fatalistic and I want to be here for a long time. I just want the world to be a better place. I want it to be, I want it to be a better place than what I grew up in, right, you know, for my children. I'm not getting that sense right
now. No, I mean, and the research proves that, you know, for the first time, we're sort of going in reverse, right? Like everyone's goal, or not everyone's, but, you know, most people's goal for their children is to help them launch into a life that's better than yours.
Of course. Right? That's what we're here. That's what we're here to do as parents. I'm not saying everybody has to be parents, but if you have children, you're to prepare the world for them to go into that is better. And I think people have just gone like this.
Yeah. And to try and put good human beings out in the world. Like that's also
100 right. forward facing. Yeah. What do I call them? Forward facing, participating members of the civil society. That's it.
Who care and want, you know, to help people and make the world better.
Yeah. And really be honest, you know, and be honest and genuine. But it's hard because, you know, it seems like there's a lot of kabuki, you know, that's what I call it. There's a lot of kabuki out there, a lot of theater, a lot of, you know, people kind of showboating and stuff. And it's like, okay, but what do I know? You know, I mean, I don't know. I just try to, you know, I don't sit there and blog about it on my Facebook page. I sit there and talk to people who, you know, have one-on-one conversations and try to find the answer to it. And sometimes you do, and sometimes you don't. And you're like, okay, but again, to my original point, always be a student. Always try to learn. Always.
Yeah, let's pivot a little back to the dad thing. You know, what's one or two things, you know, you try and, you know, do as a parent or with your kids that you really feel like is kind of a gem that other people could learn from? I mean, I talked to one guy who's like, I go home from work and I put my cell phone in my office and I don't pick it up till my kid's asleep.
That's fantastic. Yeah. I don't do that.
I don't either.
I don't do that. And you know what? I wish I could, but what I do find with my kids is that there's a lot more time kind of taking them. I find my quality time with my children is usually en route somewhere.
100%.
Taking them to softball practice, or taking them from softball practice. And my oldest daughter, she's done girls wrestling. She's gotten into that, and she's, you know, fantastic in it. And she's just, again, organically found that. She's teaching me about wrestling, and so I'm going to these wrestling matches. But a lot of these conversations don't necessarily happen at the dinner table. Look, I would love to be able to sit at we do occasionally sit down at the dinner table, or if we go out to eat, that's fine. We can do that. No cell phones at the table. You know, try to. But it's usually en route, and I have a playlist that I had them make called Girls Jams that we've had for you know, going on 10 years, and they add stuff to it, subtract stuff to it, and whenever we're in the car, it's very rarely, I would say 2% Daddy's music, 98%, you know, Raz and Daisy's music, and I'm learning from them, and so they are playing me stuff, and they're like, oh, have you heard this SZA? And I'm like, huh, okay. And then they're telling me, oh, Dad, did you know SZA is from South Orange, the town in which I grew up? I'm like, no, play it, you know. So and so, you know, they're playing me Kanye stuff, and listen, Stephen, I'm going to tell you, I don't necessarily get all this shit. I don't, but they're listening to it, so I'm trying to figure out, okay, well, what is this? What is the And there are certain things that I say, I got that. I like the Taylor Swift stuff. People, you know, people want to. I think it's fantastic. They love Taylor Swift, and I'm listening to that, and I'm sitting there going, "Look, it's not for everybody, but if it's bringing them joy, that's bringing."
Yeah, I mean, right. And who am I to judge other people's view of art and what they like? Like, I know what I like. Right. I try and share it with my kids. I, you know, make them. You know, now we make them. You know, playlists back in the day, it would have been a mixtape or something, but you know, you try and share it. You can't sweat it too much. Cause the 12-year-old who's kind of going down this pretty popular country music vein, which definitely isn't my thing, but we were driving one day, she put her phone in and I was like, oh, No Doubt's on. Okay, cool. And then, you know, that sort of vein. And I was like, all right, that's kind of a good pathway.
Sure.
But it, you know, it's that funny balance of trying to like share what you love, but not force anything on them. And I remember like when the older two, you know, I grew up playing music and, you know, like you, like music saved my life. It saves my life every day. And they, stopped like playing instruments and, you know, it's their life and their dream. Like my job's to support that and not try and make them something in a model of me or what I wished I could have done.
It's not. You just point them to the road. You say, well, here's a road over here. Here's a road over here. You want to kind of show them the lay of the land, but you don't tell them how to drive to get there. I mean, it's just, you try to, you know, give them clues. Let me ask you this, Stephen, who is your favorite band of all time? The band that you would say is the band that just is your thing.
You know, I probably would say The Clash, because that sort of was, I heard The Clash and that's what got me interested in punk. So there's kind of just always been a place in my heart for that band. Yep. How about you?
First of all, Clash, good call. Sony artist.
You know.
I can get you some Clash vinyl if you want.
Oh, 100%.
They, you know, it's interesting, you know, it's interesting you say The Clash, because when you think about The Clash were really around for a heartbeat. Yeah. They were around for 5 years, right? I mean, really. And the breadth of work that those guys did was highly ambitious and not always perfect. But when they were on, they were devastating.
Yeah.
The Clash are, you know, kind of always there. And it wasn't until like I always liked The Clash and I kind of knew about it, but it wasn't until I guess I was a senior in high school when a friend of mine gave me a Clash bootleg. And it was, it was a Clash at the Bottom Line or they were at the Palladium, but they opened up with Safe European Home. And it's like, black did that. And Topper Heaton snares like, and these guys, and it just like the studio version's one thing. The live version is just where it jumped off. And I was like, that is like the energy that I wanted to do. And I just, it never, that kind of stuff never left me. For me, I mean, it was always kind of like the band that changed my way of looking at things. I mean, I grew up on the Beatles. I grew up on Springsteen. I grew up, you know, all of my older brothers were kind of like my music historians, right? So they all kind of passed down all of this music. Kiss was a band that just blew my mind. The Monkees. But the first band that I discovered, you know, kind of on my own, you know, and then were Adam and the Ants, which is just like, and then I didn't realize that, you know, they had their punk rock roots. And then I kind of backdoored into punk rock through Adam and the Ants and also through Bowie. And then it's just this chain reaction. And then, you know, the Replacements to me were the band, if you would ask me, like in my teenage years, that was the band that just, it sounded like Paul Westerberg had opened up my, you know, my 16-year-old diary and was just singing them to the most amazing songs. And I'm sitting there going, oh my God. It was like, you know, kind of like reading Catcher in the Rye for the first time, where you're just like, this Holden Caulfield was like, oh my God, that's me. I can't believe that somebody else is sharing this experience. And that's why, like my oldest daughter, she's a freshman in high school, in West Orange High School. And they had them read The Catcher in the Rye. They're like, Dad, have you ever read Catcher in the Rye? I'm like, Dad, sit down. Let's talk. She's like, whoa, Dad. Like, Holden Caulfield is one of the greatest literary characters in history. J.D. Salinger was blah, blah, blah. And I just, you know, just going off. But so it's all of this stuff. And so it depends on you know, the era of my life. Like I went through a huge Radiohead, you know, phase where that was kind of like this musical therapy for me. And especially, and it's interesting, probably when I was, you know, doing most of my drinking was, and it was, Radiohead was like, Thom Yorke was like, oh my God, he's singing to my, you know, to my wallowing soul. And I still go back, and now my daughter's, you know, listening to them. So it's, I love stuff that is, there's some stuff that I listen to that I'm like, I go back and listen to them, I'm going, not that great. It's okay. It's good for nostalgia. But then there's the stuff that's the universal that just stays with you forever. And you're like, oh yeah. Like when you, what is your favorite, let me ask you this, your favorite Clash album?
Maybe this is controversial because Give 'Em Enough Rope was the first one I heard. And probably not in the critical standpoint viewed as their best album, but it's still a great album. And, you know, but also I love, you know, London Calling, you know, Sandinista is great. Yeah. I got to be a little more in the mood for that.
Well, that's the thing, right? Because Sandinista is so, what it's the thing is, I've always said Sandinista would make, it could be a perfect one album.
Right.
But they just went bang all over the place. And it's, but you know, hand it to them because I mean, a 3LP set, they weren't supposed to do that.
Nope.
They weren't supposed to do that. And that's why, like, when bands like, to me, like, I don't know if you got into all the SST stuff, like Minutemen and Husker Du and, you know, and all of that stuff, Black Flag and all that. I mean, that's the stuff I grew up on. And to me, it's like, I didn't really even know it was punk rock. I just thought it was crazy people music. And I was like, I love this. This is relating to me. So it's great. No, I mean, it's great. And and I still, you know, music is still very much a part of my day. And that's the wonder of Spotify, is being able to go in and kind of dig in and find these things. Oh my God, I haven't heard this album in so long. And then, you know, there it is.
Yeah. I still love sitting on my couch with my records though, because there's an intentionality to that
act
and like getting up and forcing you to listen to an album. It's like old guy talk, to an album in the track list that it was intended to be listened on. But, you know,
of course,
I listen to tons of Spotify. Like I got a 40-minute commute, like I'm playing music and it's, you know, it's all good. It's very accessible. It's easy to do. You know, you can debate the royalty structure for people all you want. I mean, I think it's tough to be a small band now. You got a tour. You got a tour, and that's
It's a different paradigm. It's you got to get out there. You got to get out there and hit the road. And that's why the you've been granted youth and energy to, you know, to kind of do this. And then once you hit it, and I've always said, if Astronaut had one hit single, I'd be calling up my guitarist and be like, all right, listen, we're going to do 20 shows a year. And we're just going to just do that. And then fine. We pay the college education and just be like, okay, that's good. But you know, it's fun. And I think that it's touring is a different thing now for, because people want to feel that thing. They want to, because music is so, it just resonates with them in this manner. So, but going back to what you were saying about the vinyl, I agree. I mean, it is kind of like that phantom limb of like when you get up and you play, you know, you grow up playing records and then you come back and, you know, you got to flip the side and you listen to it. And now turntables and speakers are being made so well and vinyl is being pressed so well. I mean, I deal with it every day. And some of these things I hear at work and I'm like, oh my God, this sounds really good. You know, so good. So
yeah, there's just a real warmth to it. I mean, who's sort of a newer band or artist that you love? Like, I'd throw out for me, Waxahachie is a band that I've like, you know, I just love what she's doing.
Yeah, you know, I just, for me, it's hard to say because I'm usually trying to follow what my, I mean, it's just what my daughters are listening to. And it's usually, you know, kind of these one-off things. So I, as far as like new artists are concerned, it's basically kind of through their lens. I'm not as actively seeking out music like I used to. It's just because it's a time thing. And I find myself listening to, you know, probably more podcasts on my commute than, you know, and music, because I listen to music at work and I listen to, you know, all this other stuff. So it's an interesting question. And it's something that probably, like, you know, like people say, oh, I got to read more books. I'm like, I'm going to listen to more new music. And if something comes across the plate that I like, I'm like, oh, okay, I like that. But I don't find myself obsessing like I used to, and being like having to find out everything, because it's just a time thing for me right now.
But I think the cool thing about that, and is maybe a way to wrap it up, is what you said, is looking through your kid's lens.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Because it keeps you young at heart, because the thing is that to be able to experience all these things through, you know, through their eyes. And it's not all, you know, puppy dog tails and ice cream, as you know. I mean, it's, you know, there's good days and bad days, but it's so beautiful. And it's like, look, and as I said, parenthood isn't for everybody, but it was definitely for me. And for me, I always say my daughters, you know, not only saved my life, but enriched my life. I mean, I was okay. Yeah, I was okay before. Now I'm just so aware and so grateful and so happy. And it's a really good feeling, because after so many years where you feel like, oh, no one understands me, or I can't, you know, and now it's like, I want to have a relationship with my children where, you know, I don't have to be their friend. I want to be their father who's been there. And I can try to kind of help you navigate through it, whether it's feelings, music, choices, or whatever. And it's weird, because I could never see myself talking to my parents in that manner, because I just felt I was so far removed from them. I just want my kids to understand that, you know, I've been there before. And it's very hard for kids to fathom that, right? I mean, it's like, it's hard for them to kind of get that thing like, oh, you did this too? Oh, wait a minute, you went through this too? And it's like, you just say, yeah, anytime you want to talk, you know, I'm happy to talk.
And I think that is an awesome thing to end on.
Thanks for listening. Sober Dad Coot is a DIY project by Stephen Kimball, who writes, edits, and produces the show. To support the show, please review it where you listen to podcasts, or visit soberdadcrew.com to buy some merchandise or make a donation.